There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino, episode 127, the review segment for Friday, August 16th, 2013. Today we're jumping ahead a week in the North American release calendar to review The World's End, the new movie from Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost, which has been out in the UK for like a month. So it's not like we're really going too crazy.
And publicized for like 8 years, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that we've been reading Jukka interviews for this since Shaun of the Dead came out.
Yes,
something like
exactly.
They just knew. They're
actually, they have been planning and talking about writing this movie for some time. And it's
That's always true.
Been like, will we get in a room with each other to write it? I feel like probably when they were publicizing Hot Fuzz, they were talking about following it up with this.
Probably with Shaun of the Dead, though I haven't really dug deep into Shaun of the Dead junket interviews. But definitely the conclusion of what they call the Three Flavors Cornetto or the
Although
Blood
I
and Ice Cream Trilogy.
I read today in one of the several million interviews that they've done recently that in this like cross-country death trek that they're on is that while filming Hot Fuzz, they noticed, or Edgar Wright noticed, a Starbucks and a McDonald's in the middle of this town and started to think about how much his quaint old English stomping grounds had changed irrevocably and began thinking about making a movie about that.
Okay.
Thank you, Starbucks. Actually, they make mention of Starbucks in the script, so I buy that.
I was getting nostalgic the other day in the East Village where there used to be one Starbucks within sight of the other Starbucks, and they tore one of them down, and it made me sad.
Really destroyed that Lewis Black bit about the end of the world. Anyway,
so The World's End. It stars once again Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, though, and they are playing different variations on the roles they've done the last two times, which we can get into later. They are part of a group of five friends who, when they were just out of high school, they attempted to participate in the Golden Mile pub crawl in their sleepy British town of Newton Haven, right?
That sounds British.
Yeah. So 20 years later, the men have gone on to do various different things, some becoming fathers or corporate guys, or Nick Frost is like, he's a lawyer, I think. But Simon Pegg's character has basically stunted himself entirely. He still wears the same jacket, drives the same car. He's trying to relive his high school glory days, which is, a familiar figure from Bon Jovi songs and various other types of media. So he gets the guys back together for another attempt, a 20th anniversary attempt at finishing.
Glory days, I think, I was going to just let this go.
I realize that Bon Jovi did not sing Glory Days.
I think we've just got to just say the word Bruce Springsteen before we move on.
Fair enough. I was trying not to lump in Bruce Springsteen with the with cliche.
This is emblematic of Simon Pegg's character, who is just in a total daze. He just kind of goes with his own flow. He's always right, as they keep saying. So this is very true to his character. You just thinking whatever you want.
Wow. Okay.
You're in character.
I'm the Arrested Development Simon Pegg of this
yes.
group of us. That's depressing. So they go back to their hometown. They attempt to finish this pub crawl, but it turns out when they get there, they realize, maybe at the one-third mark of the movie, that the town has been taken over by robots, kind of in the Stepford pod people kind of way, where everyone looks like a person, but they are, in fact, a machine with a blue goo for blood whose heads can be knocked off by hitting the sink at the right angle. So they have to decide if they're going to try to fight these robots or just escape. And in the meantime, they somehow, for various logical reasons, decide that the best way to get around it is to finish the pub crawl. So it's about their attempts to finish this pub crawl and also somehow get out of this town with their skin intact.
They do find quite a few reasons to just stay in the pub crawl, right? I feel like that is do you think that's a joke? I mean, they keep joking about it, but really...
I think that...
Why don't they just leave?
I think that the whole creative process here, the whole team, is self-aware sufficiently so that they know that how contrived it is for them to continue along this pub crawl is part of the joke.
Okay.
Well, there's also a desperation on Simon Pegg's character's part, and it gets really interesting and kind of dark near the end of the movie where you realize that he does have a legitimate problem, not necessarily even just being an alcoholic, but trying to cling to things that don't really matter.
They all really
have priorities are really screwed up.
Problems. I mean, Nick Frost is, in Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz is playing the oaf, really. And here he's playing the guy who has his shit together and has had drinking problems in the past, had a horrible accident that he's kind of continuing to be overshadowed by. I mean, he lives in with that memory and he won't drink anymore. And so going on a pub crawl is the last thing he would ever want to do. But he and cannot he say no off. To his friend, Simon Pegg.
I mean, Nick Frost as an actor, I think, pulls it off quite
he's
admirably.
He's my favorite part of the movie.
You know, I think we all have a very particular idea of who he is, whose persona is, having seen the previous films in this informal trilogy. And it's amazing. I was startled by how quickly I bought him as the one who has his shit together in this movie.
And Simon Pegg also, I mean, he's always been kind of a fuck up in their other movies, so it's not as big of a stretch. But I liked him as kind of taking a back seat and letting Nick Frost be more of the heroic figure as this movie goes on.
Yeah, but this movie has a darker edge to it than Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead. I mean, in Hot Fuzz, Simon Pegg plays someone who is very uptight and kind of aggressive in that way, in living by the rules. But here, he is so irritating and aggressive in just his abrasive behavior that it's a bold choice. I don't know if it really works on an entertainment level, perhaps, but this is definitely a riskier movie for them to make.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely commit to that character to the point where it doesn't necessarily seem entirely human, and not in the way that other things in this movie don't seem entirely human. it's such a caricature. He's so constantly ingratiating that it's I don't know, for me, both the joke and the point of that character sort of wore thin and grated on me in a way that it's supposed to grate on his friends in the movie. But on an entertaining level, as Patches was suggesting, I'm not sure if it was as dynamic as it needed to be.
I struggle with that more early on in the film as he's kind of rounding up his friends. And the other friends are played by Martin Freeman, Eddie Marsan, and Patty Considine, right? He's the
yes.
one. And they're all – Simon Pegg is driving all of them crazy too. And I kind of felt a little worn out by their disdain and how no one really seemed to want to be there. And it's hard to keep the energy level up for that. But I thought as the movie got going, as they kind of get into this robot fighting plot, you know, it gets sillier. It gets like more broader genre stuff. But I think the characters are able to do more interesting stuff from there.
But it doesn't really loosen up, which is the oddest part about the movie. I'm kind of struggling right now to figure out what our in to this movie is, our conversation about this, because it seems so broken and schizophrenic. While I did enjoy it and I found it very funny in moments, it's just all over the place in terms of what it's trying to do. And I don't know exactly the best way to talk about it, because, yeah, the beginning is really grating and off-putting on the way he's rounding up. I mean, he's an unlikable character, but he's the guy we're following as he gets the band back together. No one wants to do this, but he has some sort of persuasive quality to him that I don't think I really get. I mean, I know people like this. I think we can all identify with this character, but at a certain point when people's lives are so put together, why would anyone follow this guy into hell?
Well, it also does that thing where we're supposed to all feel as if we know somebody like this, but at the same time, we're asked to identify with him ourselves. And, you know, he represents that part of, I think, you know, so many of us, particularly those of us who live now where they did not grow up, you know, who are nostalgic
good old
and
days.
Hampered by their love for the good old days. But you're also, I think, confronted with the other side of the coin, which is knowing somebody like that and realizing, you know, there may not be such a distance between you and they.
And well, I think that we were supposed to get a sense of what they were like as high schoolers. And we kind of see it in a montage at the beginning. But one of the flaws I found as the film went on is we were supposed to have a really strong sense of this town that they grew up in and kind of feel the way that Simon Pegg does. Everything's changed. Everything's become homogenized. There's this great visual gag where they go from the first bar to the second and they're completely identical on the inside. But I don't think that we got quite enough of that backstory to feel the changes and feel the impact that their relationships had on each other as they translate into adult
life. Why I feel like this movie has strong characters in it, and it can be off-putting in the beginning as long as we either identify or we feel the foundation and we can see why it would be entrancing to go back to that town and try and, you know, Patty Considine's character has a lot of regret because he didn't get with the girl that he wants to, or Martin Freeman is trying to escape his past and be a great real estate agent, and obviously Nick Frost's character is trying to erase the horrible things that have happened to him in the past and doesn't want to confront them, but he'll be dragged along by the people he can't help but have camaraderie with. And it's a great little character piece, and the structure of a pub crawl, I think, really works for the comedy and the conversations and kind of the going, tracing the line back in time and revisiting all this again decades later. And then there's aliens and robots and fighting. Well, and I'm like, there, what the hell? And that's why I think this is a little hard to talk about for me, because I actually really enjoy the character stuff and the comedy they find there. And then all of a sudden it all gets kind of twisted up.
Well, before we get there, I mean, I think, you know, what you're saying about the characters is true, but at the same time, they rely so much on archetype and on, like, verbal repartee. I mean, very much the movie, and it's funny, it's their brand of humor, and it's something that I enjoy, but I think it's leaned on so heavily to express character here, where so much of it is these very sort of obviously telegraphed, you know, verbal jokes.
It's occupation.
Yeah, that it doesn't it doesn't really develop the characters. There's a lot of empty time, and a lot of those jokes don't land as hard as they could. I think they are aiming for quotability above any sort of other effect, and it doesn't necessarily.
Slightly,
I mean, that's really, it's a cynical thing to assign the responsibility, but I just don't think that the movie it doesn't do as much with the characters as it could, and so when things get nuts, you may not have quite the investment that you would like, but. One of the things that Edgar Wright does to compensate for that is have some of the most interesting and enjoyable action choreography that I've seen in a movie in a really long time. And this is not in a particularly expected source for you know, fight scenes that are pulled off this well. There's fight scene in a bar, in a bathroom bar. The first
bar,
fight scene in the movie.
In a bar in a bathroom.
Yeah, which is really some top-notch stuff.
Yeah, David, you were not a fan of Scott Pilgrim, right?
What? No, I love Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, you did? Okay, I can never remember who the haters of Scott Pilgrim were. I just felt like I could see Edgar Wright's training. Yeah. I did, you hated everything, right? Yeah, I could just see what he learned on Scott Pilgrim in those fight scenes. And Scott Pilgrim had these crazy big kinetic fight scenes. He, you know, these actors trained for a long time. And Edgar Wright really took that with him. The fight scenes, I agree with you, are really fantastic. And there's chase scenes that are great. I mean, Hot Fuzz had a lot of, you know, Michael Bay-inspired car chases, which just doesn't get into as much. But I really enjoyed the action of it. And you're right, it does help you kind of get past the weaknesses in the character, which had been a strength of his work before, that kind of meshing genre with character. But the way that the action is done so well that I could look past that.
I will echo that sentiment, although I think I got a little exhausted of it after maybe the fourth or fifth encounter with these robot creatures. You know, we're back in a bar setting. We're having the same kind of fight over again. That first scene that you're describing in the bar bathroom is so well choreographed, jumping from, you know, it probably isn't one actual shot, but the way that they kind of mesh these different encounters, all five guys are in the bathroom fighting different people, and the way they're swinging back and forth and using body parts to hit other people, I mean, it's really well executed.
It tires me out
and it never really meshes into the character story
What makes it less effective over time is that the first fight is not only the most interestingly choreographed, but it's also the enemies are the most menacing because you don't know
nothing
about them yet.
Yeah.
And as the movie goes on, you realize how easily defeatable these things are. I mean, how they're plastic, more or less. I mean, there's really no threat beyond the emotional one they pose to the friendships at the core of this movie. The fight scenes, which continue on, really lose their potency.
I think we might need to get into spoilers at some point, but I want to ask you guys if you think that the robots taking over the town makes sense for the characters and the story and the themes as much as the zombies did in Shaun of the Dead or the Michael Bay parody did in Hot Fuzz, because I felt like there was a weakness there where it kind of tries to explain around it where it's like, oh, your town isn't what it used to be, it feels different, but it just didn't, the genre mashup didn't go as well for me in this one.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's why, you know, I enjoyed almost all the individual aspects of this movie. But it didn't, you know, the Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and especially for me, Scott Pilgrim, everything really felt like it was working towards the same end. And here I really did feel that struggle between the story they chose and the themes that they were trying to express with it. And it really felt like it has to work very hard to combine them. And I think that's really hammered home in a really amusing, again, in a vacuum, a very amusing scene at the end of the film where, you know, you sort of get the master plan laid out for you.
Yeah, it kind of gets into that monologuing scene, which is something that you don't have when there's zombies. Although Hot Fuzz does have that monologuing scene too, and it works.
But in Hot Fuzz, it feels a little bit more organic, and there's like such a. It's so the way that Hot Fuzz crescendos and then ends in this glorious kaiju fight, which is, you know, I will not take this as an opportunity to just go out of my way and slag Pacific Rim. But I think that here, again, as wonderful as that scene is, I think the necessity of that scene in this movie, not its execution, but the necessity for it, says a lot about how the storytelling is fared to that point.
Well, I wanted to say one more thing before anyone turns off for spoilers. I think Eddie Marsan is so good in this. And I love Eddie Marsan. Yeah, they all really are. I mean, but like Martin Freeman's part is like, you know, fairly small and it feels kind of familiar for Martin Freeman. But Eddie Marsan, he's like, you know, he'd been bullied by this guy and he runs into this bully from high school and you can't really figure out the backstory there. And he has these really fantastic scenes there. So kudos to
Eddie. Even like I love Patty Considine in this movie, and his relationship with Rosamund Pike is this girl is actually Martin Freeman's sister in the movie, and who he's always kind of longed for, and I like their relationship. I just love Martin Freeman. I mean, he has such great comic timing and presence and like clowning abilities.
He has that one best facial expression when they walk out of the bathroom and try to act normal.
They don't really find enough opportunities to let these guys be the characters and really pop in comedic banter back and forth. I think it's always getting muddled by, we have to go back to the robot body snatcher people. Remember, don't forget that. Like, there's not enough time to let you sit around and actually talk because there's this problem that's always revealing itself, so we have to go back to it. Whereas in the beginning of the film, you can sit around and have a conversation. And this movie doesn't really afford itself that time and that luxury.
Okay, I guess that's the spoiler jump off point. Let's start the spoiler section by mentioning that Pierce Brosnan is in this movie, which I don't think I realized.
Well, he's in the beginning,
he's in the beginning in like a flashback, and for a second I was like, wait, Timothy Dalton again?
Yeah, right? He's playing the Timothy Dalton, except with less screen time and less of a vital role than Timothy Dalton.
Yeah, so we see Pierce Brosnan in the kind of montage in the beginning to show him as their high school teacher, and then we run into him again. He's very coiffed, and they're in the process of trying to figure out what the hell is going on with these robots. And then it turns out, Pierce Brosnan's a robot. And I saw this movie a week ago, and I still can't totally remember why.
The latter half of the movie just feels very slapdash to me. Like, throughout and this is an obvious awareness of how long I've been hearing these guys talk about making this movie, but I couldn't help but think that the script is a little undercooked in a way where, you know, Shaun of the Dead is so tight and so perfect. Every scene seems vital, and every scene lends itself to the thematic and the comedic elements of the film. And here, I just feel like it's all kind of being thrown together. Like, we got to get through this scene. We got to get them to this place, X, Y, Z. It just felt really slapdash.
Yeah, I couldn't help but thinking that when Martin Freeman departs the movie because he's the first of the friends to be turned into a robot, it was because he had to go run off and film The Hobbit. Like, I assume that they just had to get rid of him.
That's probably true. Again, and the other thing is, I think it's a little careless, and I didn't want to get into this without spoiling, because, you know, Nick Frost doesn't drink. He's sober. And then all of a sudden, he starts drinking. And I don't know, I don't know if that's a spoiler, but it annoyed me. It's just like,
that
it seems like careless character stuff.
It is so cavalier.
Like, he has to be drinking in order to get further into the script. And it doesn't seem true to his character. And I feel like the script has a lot of moments like that that just don't seem true. It just has to be this way so that we can get to the next stage. It feels like a video game.
To its credit for how it treats alcoholism, though, there is a scene when they finally do get to the World's End and there's this confrontation between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost that, I mean, the context of it in terms of story and, like, who's trying to get what doesn't totally make sense, but I thought the honesty of that conversation about addiction.
They're good actors. Really, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are good actors. Nick Frost especially.
And obviously they know each other incredibly well and can work a scene like that perfectly. Yeah. And I don't know, that worked for me, even though a lot of what was going on there, as we can talk about, was not...
Well, what did you think of the end of this film? Because obviously, I mean, for me, the end where they encounter Bill Nighy as the voice of this I guess they're an alien race that comes. They want to wipe people out because everybody is too stuck on their phones or something. And
it's about creating peace. It's like we're gonna colonize this planet. We're gonna put little pockets of robots in these.
I mean, it's similar in a way to Hot Fuzz. That sort of cultish mentality you know, the great are good.
And it's just this monologue.
That's where you guys go, the great are good.
But, the great are good.
Completely let me down.
Sorry about that. Just like this movie. It just fizzles out so hard, and the scene, it goes on and on and on, and I'm like, what is happening here? What were they thinking? And then the epilogue, which is a whole nother beast, but
I was more okay with the Bill Nye robot monologue scene than you were, I think. I feel like it ended well when they kind of, you know, stake together and say that humans are more stubborn and idiotic than you can possibly imagine. I don't mind the, like, human sticking up for the saving humanity part.
What's your beef with the epilogue?
Well, wait, what do you think about the end? What do you think about the Bill Nighy, how the whole thing wraps up?
I mean, whatever, it's fine. I mean, I think that it's at that point, it's what they had to do. And as I said, I think the scene is brilliant fun.
It doesn't seem like it's about the characters anymore, does it? I mean, isn't that what we're trying to invest in here? Isn't that what makes this movie special and not just another generic sci-fi movie?
At that point, though, I mean, when you're 100 and some odd minutes into the movie, and I didn't really care about the characters, I wasn't relying on that scene to start. I wanted an adequate explanation as to what was going on, and I got that. And I think that the scene is entertaining in and of itself, as all of these scenes are. But I think that the epilogue is really interesting, not only because it's so unexpected, but also because I've had some conversations with people who have had very different readings of it. Some people think it's, and we're talking full spoilers here.
Yep.
I mean that they think that the fact that he's palling around with the robot clones of his high school friends suggests that he has sort of regressed, and it's a sad ending, suggests that he can't grow up. And I think that is using the text in a way that it's not really presented, and extrapolating in a way that's not supported by the evidence, and maybe giving the movie even more sort of emotional credit than it deserves. Because I think the statement is rather simple.
That doesn't read to me that, because he orders water at the end, doesn't he?
He's a changed man.
That seems like a clear, I am the better man now. I'm the better version of myself because I am drinking water. Right. And
but he was able to find a piece of, you know, it's nice that he was able to live in a world where he could permanently pal around with his high school friends. I don't think it looks at that as the fact that, like, he's diminished in some way or that he's failed. I think it really gets the best of both worlds for that character.
But, I mean, are you allowed to have that in a movie like this where he needs to make a drastic change, where he's supposed to have an awakening? Can he kind of slip back a little bit with these everlasting versions of friends? What?
Yeah, but he has a purpose. He's traveling the world as this, like, vigilante in this crazy post-apocalyptic world. I think he's been fully broken out of his rut. And if he's got the robot version of his friend, I mean, he's kind of found the balance between his nostalgia for the past and living life as a functional human.
Yeah.
Maybe I was caught off guard by how different that ending is, and it's allowed to go crazy.
As an ending for a movie, it's crazy. I mean, the idea, like, I think I was telling you this before, like, the idea that at the end of a We Averted the Apocalypse movie, that then, oh no, the apocalypse actually comes, and there's actual consequences to the big fireball. I think that was kind of cool, even if it was totally jarring.
It's kind of cool. It just wasn't fulfilling for me as someone who, again, invested in the first third of this movie, want to see the characters pay off and see them learn something. I guess it doesn't need to be overt. I mean, he obviously does learn something.
Well, you know, when you're calling your movie The World's End,
The World's Better End,
this is the end. But, you know, that movie was honest as well, that you can't. And they had an escape route here, because it's actually the name of a bar. So they could say, you know, we lied to you, but we didn't really, because it's the name of a location in the movie. But the movie's called The World's End. It's got The World's End in it and all, you know.
Oh, and as they're wrapping up their trilogy, you know, they basically averted Apocalypse and Shaun of the Dead, and in Hot Fuzz, kind of a more minor kaiju battle apocalypse. You know, this is their chance to kind of go balls out and make everything go crazy. So they went for it. That's, I mean, maybe it's the way of them being like, no, we're not going to make a fourth one. We ended the world the last time. What more do you want?
Yeah, it's not as if these are contiguous worlds. You know,
right.
The next movie would rely on this one. But
no, I think now is the time for them to really to make a direct sequel.
Yeah. Although I will end this spoiler section by offending David, I assume, by asking you how you would rank your Cornetto trilogy.
Oh, I thought you were just going to be like, I hate Jews.
Yeah. Well, by telling David I'm a Holocaust supporter. No. Well, it's funny because I walked out of the world's end with a group of people, as most people do with movies, and the immediate conversation that people were jumping to was like, where does this rank for you in the Cornetto trilogy? And I'm like, I didn't love Shaun of the Dead. I love the most, I think, and I've always had a tough relationship with Hot Fuzz. I just recently revisited it, and it's funnier than I think I remember it being. But I may put World's End maybe at the bottom of my Cornetto trilogy list now. It might go Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, World's End for me.
Well, I think there's like a little meta narrative here of Edgar Wright having to go back and do this and get it out of his system to move on and make bigger and better things, because only one of his features was not part of the Cornetto trilogy,
right.
And it happened, by my estimation, to be his best movie, Scott Pilgrim. So, you know, much like Nolan graduating from the Batman movies, I think the best thing I can say about The World's End is that it ends the trilogy.
that sounds really harsh.
No, that does sound really harsh. I actually enjoyed this movie quite a bit. I do think it is, by a rather significant margin, the weakest of the Cornetto films, but he sets a rather high bar for himself. I don't know. I think Shaun of the Dead is probably my favorite, but I really think that Patches undervalues Hot Fuzz.
I don't love Michael Bay and that kind of stuff as much as
you
do. I know Bad Boys, your connection to Bad Boys 2.
Any of the other ones has the most fun taking the piss out of other movies, obviously.
Sure.
I mean, maybe not obviously, but I think even more so than Shaun of the Dead, it excels in that respect. And it feels really epic, and I really, really enjoy it.
I may grow to appreciate World's End more, though, because I really like how dramatic it ends up going, and I think that these guys all have a handle on that. Like, I'm amazed that it can be as dark as it gets without feeling too phony. So.
Well, remember, there's a scene in Shaun of the Dead where Sean has to kill his own mother. I mean, it gets... Shaun of the Dead has... Yeah. And I think that's one of the things... I mean, to answer your initial question, I think it's like the Back to the Future trilogy. It's a very easy 1-2-3 order ranking for me.
Well, F you, because Back to the Future 3 is better than Back to the Future 2, but that's for a whole different podcast.
We will have a whole different fight about that. But yeah, I think that darkness has been there, but I also admire the way the world's end. And I think that maybe once you know the ending and once you kind of get what role the robots are going to play and where the narrative is going to take you, you might be able to enjoy those acting moments and the smaller stuff more.
One quick question, unrelated bonus. Related to Zemeckis.
What?
Oh, because of Back to the Future?
Yes. Can either of you, in order, name the five films that Zemeckis directed in the 1980s?
Whoa.
Well, Back to the Future was one of them.
No, it wouldn't have been the first. Did he direct Used Cars?
Yes.
Wait, Back to the Future was in the 80s.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be the first one in order.
Oh, I have to name
them
in order.
Used Cars was before it.
Oh.
And then, I'm jumping.
Roger Rabbit was 89, I think.
Yeah, and that was before.
I didn't want to add an hour to this podcast.
What is the order?
It's a question.
All right, tell us.
Well, the first was Used Cars in 1980. And I believe the second was Back to the Future in 1985.
That's a big gap.
Although, hold on, I'm just double-checking right now, you know, because I don't want to do our listeners wrong.
There's a place on the internet to learn this.
Romancing the Stone was 84.
Oh.
Back to the Future was 85. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 88. And Back to the Future Part 2, 89.
Wow.
This concludes the World's End spoiler section.
Don't be afraid of your freedom!
Guys, before we get into the lightning round question, I think we should talk more about Robert Zemeckis. That's really the
well,
focus
I went
of
to,
this week's podcast.
I thought it was a fun little bonus to throw to the readers. I went to Videology's weekly trivia night last night.
Videology is a bar in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
It's a video store, isn't it?
Yes, I didn't. I don't. I would explain. I'm not sure if this is making it onto the show, but I thought I wasn't sure if that was
everything
for you guys,
makes
but
it into the show.
It is a bar in Williamsburg on every Tuesday night. If you want to see at least, you know, the most noxious quarter of Opkino, you can probably go there. I'm on a team. I was inducted to my roommate's team. It is very heated. It is very intense. We lost to La Aventura, What Nature Calls is the team we lost to.
That's
which
really
is populated
good.
By IFC staffers. The director of This Is Martin Bonner, and the director of Bachelorette, and the director of The Color Wheel. So they had a stacked roster. But
what was your team name?
I did not have a hand in naming this, but it's a good team name nonetheless. It's A Few Good Menopause. But the season starts. The next season starts in September, and so I'm already helping to brainstorm another name. The next iteration of our team. It was great fun, but that was one of the questions.
So next week's lightning round question is: find David's new trivia team name. Yeah. That is a portmanteau of other names.
Satin Tango and Cash was already taken. Air Will Be Bud was really good, and then my favorite by far was the 400 Bros.
Well,
serious geekery going on.
Yes, seriously. Before we make you name David's trivia question or trivia team name, Patches, what was this week's lightning round question?
This week's lightning round question was, in honor of Jobs, the Steve Jobs biopic, what film best portrays an American pop culture figure or icon? David?
David has not looked this up yet.
So many people said I'm not there. And I have to say that even though I was not enamored by that movie when I saw it at New York Film Festival, whenever it came out, even though I haven't seen it since, I find myself thinking about it a lot. It left quite an impression. So I'll give it up to any one of them. Let's see. I'll go with Coria Todd. Who says,
Why did it make an impression?
I mean, I think it's... to be perfectly honest, I respect the approach.
It's just cool, man.
I think that, you know, it's not entirely dissimilar from Mishima, which is a very outspoken, is my favorite biopic. I think it's actually like a very close cousin to that movie and how it sort of splits Dylan's personality to get at him. And I had my professor is the writer of that movie, Orin Moverman, and he was talking about it a lot of the semester and everything he was saying about it. I was like, I'm not sure if it works in execution, but in theory, the approach I thought was really ingenious. I'd like to see more biopics that are unconventional like that. Even if the Richard Gere, Billy the Kid shit drove me nuts. But whatever. So Coria Todd says, the only answer is I'm not there as a portrait of Bob Dylan. Not the only answer, because it's not even the right answer. Whatever I gave last week. I don't even remember. But Coria Todd, ladies and gentlemen.
I was also going to say I'm not there. So
oh,
now
my
I'm going to go with something else. Duncan House, who says Ed Wood, Tim Burton, and Johnny Depp's loving tribute to the bracingly weird tendency of the camp auteur. And I do greatly enjoy Ed Wood, even though I don't think I was familiar with him as a person and before I saw that movie. So now basically Johnny Depp's Ed Wood is Ed Wood as far as I'm concerned.
He is Ed Wood.
Ed Wood Scissorhands.
A lot of people said The Aviator.
A lot of people.
I think we should recognize that fact. Like, I'd say 50% of the people who answered this question said The Aviator. I didn't realize people love that movie so much. I think I've seen it twice. Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints.
Show me the blueprints.
Way the future. Way the future. Way the future.
So maybe that's the reason. Maybe people have just been repeating those lines since then, and they can't get The Aviator out of their heads.
Show me the blueprints.
I am going to go with Mario Allegri, who mentioned one of my favorite films of all time. From the directors of Girl Most Likely comes American Splendor, the Harvey Pekar film. I just adore that movie. I really do. I just think it's super sweet. I think Paul Giamatti is perfect in it. And I love how, again, it's a slightly unconventional doing the interview stuff. And I don't know. I continue to love that film and all the animation in it. Just a different approach, the right approach.
Show me all the blueprints.
Show me the blueprints.
That's irrelevant. Harvey Pekar did not draw blueprints. He drew comics.
Way the future. Way the future.
I hate you guys.
Way the future. That does it for today's Operation Kino. We'll be back next week with a review episode and a main episode. and so many other things to discuss. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I am on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches, P-A-T-C-H-E-S. All my work is on mattpatches.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at film.com. And you can also find me at film.com.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-A-C-H. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Show me the blueprints.
It's that little souvenir of a terrible year. Such a rat.